Up in the 50s, we were a creditor, one of the world's largest creditors. We're now not only a debtor, we are the world's largest debtor. And our continuation day by the Treasury has to acquire about $3 billion per day just for the status quo. And that comes from lenders that aren't stupid. They realize they're going to get paid back with cheaper dollars. They're not dumbbells. So as a result, the T-bond prices are plunging. Interest is surging. And we don't have to go through all the arithmetic here except to point out there's a lack of confidence broadly growing at a greater speed than any time in history. And despite the Federal Reserve's efforts to counter it, the Federal Reserve is trying to do everything they possibly can to counter this, and it's not working. And so to buy bonds, the Fed must print money. The more it prints, the more it fans inflation fears, and the more it chases away the bond investors who realize they'll be paid back in cheaper dollars. You always think, gee, they can print all the money they want. No, that's funding debt. Someone's got to pick up the notes, and they're not stupid. So without insider foresight, the Feds have entered into a vortex that's impossible to step out of. The main reason investors sell, fear of inflation and damage to the U.S. government's credit, to the U.S., they are themselves fueled by this money printing binge that they're on, and it risks, of course, triggering a massive investor selling. Now, if you look at the Department of Treasury's seal, it's interesting you notice in the center of the seal, there's a very prominent structure called scales, right? And I'm sure that should remind you of Proverbs 11:1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, and a just weight is his delight. As they diddle with the dollars, they are playing with the measuring. That's considered treasonous, in spirit at least. So it appears the financial policies of this country are coming under judgment. And we'll get into some of that. Now, there's some very interesting editorials being published all around the world. The one that intrigues me the most is this one by our friend Mishkin. It says, American capitalism has gone with a whimper. It must be said that like the breaking of a great dam, the American descent into Marxism is happening with breathtaking speed against a backdrop of passive, hapless sheeple. People. And this is published in Proverbs, but it says, again, the American public has taken this with a barely a whimper, but a free man whimper. Little more than the grumbling of a desperate self-delusion of a lost, misguided slave dreaming dreams of his uniqueness and freedom. A fool's desperate escape into flights of fantasy and distraction. And, you know, there is a cycle of nations. We need to understand that nations, like any organism, has a life cycle, has an origin, up, and final demise. And the cycle of nations has been studied by many great historians throughout history. Alexander Tyler back in the 1750s, Edward Gibbon, Joad, Northcote Parkinson, Jim Nelson Black. All these classic studies have essentially the same conclusion. Civilizations seem to last about two centuries. They grow, and they flourish, they die. The symptoms of the death of a nation turn out to be very descriptively predictable. First thing, there's social decay, crisis of lawlessness. And by the way, when you disregard our Constitution in this country, that's the ultimate lawlessness. And you're finding that disregarded in every sector. The loss of economic discipline. Does that sound familiar? The rising bureaucracy. We have what now? 32 czars appointed by the president that are not accountable to the people that have all the power. What's going on here? That leads, of course, it goes to cultural decay, decline of education, weakening of cultural foundations, loss of respect for traditional values. I used to think the increasing cost and decreasing value of our education system was due to mismanagement. Until you do some homework, you discover no, it's designed to be that way. That's a deliberate agenda. I hope that's preposterous enough to challenge you to check that out for yourself. And, of course, the real problem here isn't either of these. It's moral decay. The rise of immorality, the decay of religious belief, and devaluing of human life. So our present predicament, let's take a look at it. America's in moral freefall. Our problems are not financial. Those are symptoms, not the cause. Our problems are moral. We're victims of spiritual warfare. We have a media masking the truth, and never has that been more demonstrable than in the 2008 elections, where the media conspicuously withheld truth from the American people to favor their own agenda. That should be called treason. The purpose of the media in a democracy is to inform the electorate. When they fail to do that, that should be a crime. But the conspiracy of the media, there's a whole teaching on that. But anyway, we move on here. The courts that pervert justice. We have schools deliberately dumbing down our youth. That's the goal of Goals 2000 and all the rest of it. We have replaced our traditional heritage with multiculturalism, revisionism, and values. Well, how can you have a university teaching, searching for truth when they deny the existence of truth? What's the relevance? Why even study history if there's no real truth? Well, that's the reason you study history, to get some, to assume there's lessons useful for the future. And we teach our kids that they're products of random cosmic accidents, and then we wonder why they have no sense of destiny. I mean, come on. Now, traditional patriotism. I spent 30 years in the strategic arena. When other guys were in college, I was passing in review on Warden Field for whatever dignitary was visiting Washington that week at the Naval Academy. That gets in your blood. And after my service career, I spent time in the strategic arena, the E-ring, the Pentagon, and in the think tank world. And I'm not an America basher. I've served on 12 public boards of directors. Six of those I was CEO of. These are public companies. Four of those were defense contractors. So it's in my blood. And yet, the last couple of years have been painful for me because I've had to come to grips with the fact that what I used to regard as patriotism, I now regard as obsolete idol worship, clinging to a myth of the past. The America of the 50s and 60s is a myth of the past. It's no longer operative. There is a cycle of nations. They start in bondage, attain to spiritual faith, which leads to great courage, and that courage can yield liberty. And in our case, it certainly did. In fact, that liberty leads to abundance. And boy, that's been our history. And it's led to an abundance that's been the envy of the world. Ah, that's the rub, isn't it? That's perhaps the part of the problem. That abundance then leads to complacency. And that complacency leads to apathy. And when I travel, I challenge the foreign friends. I say, when you go to America, go down the street and ask the first person you meet, what is the biggest problem in America? Is it ignorance or is it apathy? And the guy will say, I don't know and I don't care. It's humorous and yet pathetic. And of course, that apathy leads to dependency. You know, the things that we used to think were results of achievements are now entitlements, you see. And that, of course, leads back to bondage. Now, it's up to you to figure out where we are on that cycle. A couple of interesting summits were held in the last few months. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, held its 9th summit. That's an intergovernmental organization founded in 2001 in China's Shanghai municipality by China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And what makes this interesting, see, there are even nations that have just observer status here within that group: Mongolia, Pakistan, India, and guess who? Iran. That's rather interesting. You see, this showcases, if you will, the growth of importance of China and India, as well as their partnering with Russia, but it also is interesting that Iran desires to become a member. That means she's casting her chips with the East, not the West, economically speaking. The other summit was BRIC. That stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And these four nations now, you'll see in the news more and more, is BRIC, B-R-I-C. And in 2001, these nations comprised 7% of the global GDP. Within the following 8 years, they now have doubled that percentage. That's called market share. And it's predicted that within another decade, or no more than two, they will account for over 50% of the GDP of the planet Earth. And these summits were specifically intended to counterbalance what their leaders feel is Western hegemony, especially the unilateral decisions, as they look at it, of the United States. And they see some of these things as a shot across the bow of Obama and his foreign policies. Interesting communique came out of the recent BRICS summit. It says the U.S.-born credit crisis, notice their orientation here, the U.S.-born credit crisis paralyzed financial markets and triggered a global-sized recession. And furthermore, the weakening dollar, as well as the irresponsible steps taken by Washington to shift its own troubles to others, has already dealt a harsh blow to capital pegged to the dollar. And so David Mason, in his book, The End of the American Century, says, as the dynamic economies of India and China and the revitalized European Union overtake those of the United States, we will witness a fundamental transformation on the global scene. And incidentally, the People's Bank of China, in the last few weeks, is now calling on the world to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency and for the IMF to issue a new single super sovereign currency. That won't be easy to do. That'll take time, but it's inevitable. It's coming. And the evaporation of the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency really ties, it really will destroy our ability to borrow the way we have been used to doing. And so, but stand back from all of this and get another perspective. We all recognize the cradle of civilization was in the Mesopotamian Valley. Mesopotamia means between the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. And that's where the civilizations first started. But it's interesting to notice how they go from the Babylonian to the Persian, and then the Persians to the Greeks, and then the Greeks to the Rome. Notice how the centroid of power seems to migrate westward. And of course, through the 16th and 17th century, it was really the time of Northern Europe. The Dutch, the Germans, the Spanish, the Brits, they all had their shot at it, some several times. But that's when you get to the 19th century, of course, that centroid of power shifts to the United States. And Henry Luce mentioned in 1941 that the 20th century was the American century, and it really was. But that was last millennium, wasn't it? That centroid of power is moving, continuing to move westward. And most analysts are quick to recognize that the 21st century will be dubbed the Asian century. But it's not going to end there either, right? It's going to continue going to back to where it all started. That's exactly what the Bible said all along. And we're going to watch that shift take place. The speed at which it's moving is also accelerating for lots of technological reasons. Well, if you want to know what time it is on God's calendar, you always check what? Israel, right? So let's take a look at this. Let's set aside some myths. I think most of you are sophisticated enough not to harbor these myths in your plans. You know, the Romans renamed that region that we speak of as Palestina. It was really their way of calling it the land of the Philistines. And that we had the rebellion, you remember, in AD 66, which led to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. A few years later, Bar Kokhba had his revolt in 132. And it took them 3 years for the 12th Legion to put them down and all that. In fact, they suffered a defeat that they never outlived, but the Romans finally put them down. But by then, Hadrian had concluded that they could never rule that land as long as there was Jewish presence. So that's when they renamed it after the enemies of Israel, the Philistines. In Latin, that was Palestina, and that gave it the label of Palestine, which if you use that label today, you're using the label of Israel's enemies. Just understand that. It later, from the Romans then, it became the eastern leg of that empire outlived the western leg by 1,000 years. And yes, the Antichrist will come from the Roman Empire, but not from Western Europe. He's going to come from the eastern leg. Micah tells us who he is. Isaiah tells us who he is. There's a whole study you can get into on that if you like. But after the Byzantine Empire, the Muslims overran it. They ruled it from Damascus or Baghdad, never Jerusalem. And then came the Crusaders, who had it off and on for a little bit. The Mamluks then took over, but they ruled it from Egypt. Then the Turks ruled it from Istanbul. And that comes to World War I ended all of that. The British have the mandate then to establish that region as a homeland for Israel, but they abrogated that by taking 75% of that mandate and creating out of thin air the state of Jordan. But there's never been a Palestinian state. There's never been a Palestinian language. That's a myth, and we need to understand that. The world has sided with Islam in its false claim to the land of Israel, which is now inaccurately called Palestine. The promised land, was given to Israel by the God of the Bible, and it was occupied by Jews continuously for the last 3,000 years, and they are the only people to have done so. And you need to do your homework on this and understand this, because a lot of people try to con you about that, but it's well documented. You can sort it out. See, it's in recognition of that undeniable historic fact that, that all of Palestine was to be given to the Jews for a national homeland by a 1917 ruling of the League of Nations. That was all confirmed then, but abrogated by the Brits. But moving on, let's just take one prophecy. We could make a whole study of this, obviously, but let's take one prophecy out of Zechariah 12. It follows. The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel. Oh, by the way, I'm presuming you can see all that. Okay, good. The burden of the Lord, the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundation of the earth and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, God speaking, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be torn in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. All the people of the earth, not just their neighbors. Now, you know, back 2,500 years ago, when this was penned by Zechariah, that probably made sense. Jerusalem was a big deal. But, you know, this is really, when you stand back, rather absurd. In a modern world, here's a city that has no natural resources, doesn't even have a harbor. It isn't any longer on a strategic site of caravan route or anything. The city has absolutely no relevance to a modern world except religiously. And I thought we lived in an a-religious world. And yet, this says that it's going to be a bone in the throat, so to speak, for all the nations of the planet Earth. The city! That's ridiculous! Cup of trembling to all nations. That is ostensibly absurd. It makes no sense. And yet we smile at ourselves as we come to that conclusion because we realize that while we're meeting here this weekend, the late lights are burning among every staff group, of every headquarters group, of every nation that is internationally relevant, struggling about what position to take regarding Jerusalem. It's astonishing to see how timely this is. This is a reality. This verse leaps at us today because we are engaged in this whole fallacy of the so-called peace process. And yes, that slide is misspelled on purpose. Okay? Why? Because it's built on a false premise. The premise of all these discussions is not the size of Israel. It's the existence of Israel. And that because of all of this, it's assuring a armed conflict, probably nuclear. The world today, hour by hour, is under the threat of a nuclear war over the city of Jerusalem. We'll talk a little bit about that more as we go on here. All of this, of course, is in our materials if you want to do some homework. Now, for the first time in our history, see, one of the things, when I travel, one of the questions that we always get asked is, you know, why hasn't God judged America? Anybody with spiritual sensitivity, Billy Graham quipped several decades ago, if God doesn't judge America, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Why hasn't God? And the retreat that most of us as speakers take, the reason we haven't been judged is because we feel that Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, is a shield of a judgment. Because God says, I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee. And because we have stood for Israel's right to exist, we, with all our faults and with all our bunglings and all our betrayals, still, we feel that that's what shielded us from an overdue judgment up until today. For the first time in our history, our chief executive has put our support of Israel on the bargaining table. Ooh. You know, we always have several trips a year. We got a insider's trip with the Mossad and all that coming up here in the end of October. People always say, Chuck, aren't you worried about Israel? No, I'm not worried about Israel. I don't feel threatened when I'm there. Never have been. We've done that twice a year for decades. I'm not worried about Israel. Why? Because he that keepeth Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. That's God's problem. They're in his hand. And he knows how to take care of that. I don't worry about Israel. I worry about America. Because I felt America's security came from our support of Israel. Now, someone who doesn't have biblical background thinks that's silly, but if you have a biblical understanding, wow, that's the best protection you can have. Up until now, I tremble now for America because of this policy. And so Obama's got a dangerous game. He has conditioned the historic U.S. support of Israel. He is ceasing the use of the video against the UN resolutions that are not in the interests of Israel. 60% of the resolutions in the General Assembly and 60% of the resolutions in the Security Council over the last several decades involve Israel. That's silly. There's more problems in Israel on the planet Earth. But 55 to 60% of the resolutions are... The fact that they even involved Israel is surprising. They're all against Israel. You need to understand the anti-Semitic posture there. Obama's been in office a few months. Jordan has got commitment for $513 million in 2009. Egypt received another $310 million in supplemental appropriations over and above what they also had, already had. Palestinian Authority got $600 million. $300 million to the Hamas regime in Gaza. You know, this goes over great in Tel Aviv, you know. So Netanyahu's war cabinet is the largest in Israel's political history, combining the center-right, center-left, and the far-right parties. That's the war cabinet that you're looking at. They just completed, a few weeks ago, one of the largest military exercises of their history. A training exercise, understand, but it was full-scale, long-range. Long-range, 900-mile swing here. Distance that they went to. It was monitored by foreign intelligence agencies. It involved more than 100 F-15 and F-16s. Refueling out and back, helicopters to rescue down pilots and all that sort of thing, and 900 miles across the Mediterranean, 900 miles from Israel. The point they're making, that's the distance between Tel Aviv and Iran's nuclear facilities at Natanz. So, and this was a full-scale doohickey. I won't go through all the rest of it, other than the first time the Israeli Air Force practiced maneuvers against Iran, not just Syria, and so forth. And these successful runs were then followed up by the largest five-day nationwide emergency exercise that involved the whole population for like what they might call a doomsday scenario. It's called Turning Point 3. And while all this is going on, the media, Israeli media, continually leaked reports that hint of a scenario in which Israel could become fed up with the U.S. diplomatic delays, and launch a unilateral strike on their own. In the middle of this, Obama is screaming, and yet Biden behind the scenes is saying, there's no reason they shouldn't, they're a sovereign nation. And is that a gaffe? Biden's famous for those. Or was it a back-channel message? But in any case, Israel, see, believes that Iran, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they're over. They see it essential for their survival. And they believe they'll have that capability sometime, the way the official terms are between 2009 and 2012. But if you talk to every year, we get briefed by the Mossad, Shin Bet, the security service, Knesset, and the IDF. And when you assemble that data, you quickly discover they believe it's a matter of months, not years. And so the U.S. official position is that the time frame is, Iran won't have it until after 2013. Where did they get that number? Well, that's the year after the election. The main facilities that are critical sites are three, really. The nuclear fuel cycle involves Isfahan, the nuclear research center, and that's where the uranium conversion facilities are, some 50,000 centrifuges. And then Natanz is the enrichment facility is at Natanz. And that's the 50,000 centrifuges. The plutonium production, and plutonium, you're talking weapons now, see? Plutonium production is in Arak, the heavy water plant and the future plutonium production center. This is a picture of Natanz, the underground facilities where the centrifuges are installed. They cover about some 670,000 square feet in total. And it was built 8 meters deep into underground and then protected by a concrete wall 2.5 meters thick. In 2004, it was hardened with a roof of several meters of additional reinforced concrete and buried under a layer of earth some 75 feet deep. So you're talking a pretty heavy target here. And it may shock you to discover you can do that, you can hit this without using nuclear weapons. A nuke, of course, would be handy, but there's other ways to do it. At Esfahan, they have the industrial-scale uranium facility. And then at Iraq, we have the heavy water reactors and all of that stuff. And so the probable path, there's three different strategies, but the probable one is the northern route, and in which that profile would be low altitude, high altitude, and then low altitude. And they have to be refueled in both directions, by the way. And so they're going high, then low, then high, and come back. But the weapons would be the GBU-27, probably 2,000-pound class penetrating warhead. It penetrates about 2 meters of concrete, depending on the angle of attack, and it most likely be the weapon against Isfahan uranium facility. The big brother of the GBU-27 is the GBU-28, 5,000-pound class penetrating warhead. Penetrates at least 6 meters of concrete and 30 meters of earth. And they use a pair of these laser-guided, one behind the other, what they sometimes call the bunker buster. And so it's heavy stuff. Now, in the scenario that I'm showing you here, the Israeli strike is regarded by most of the think tanks that have studied this as feasible. Total force would be 25 F-15Es for a strike and F-7 F-16s and 38 F-16s for escort or fight and suppression of air defense. Did I say that right? Yeah, 25 of the F-15s accompanied with six F-16s, additional 38 F-16s for escort and what have you. And the allocated strike force against nuclear targets would be 70 aircraft. If you allow about 30% attrition, you're talking over 100 aircraft for the program. And the other alternative is to use Jericho 3 with nukes. And Iran is negotiating with Russia for their highly vaunted anti-ballistic missile defense system, the Favorit. And near as we understand, they haven't concluded that, nor have they been installed. That window is closing. In the meantime, they could use Jericho 3, which would be less loss of life, but would involve nuclear weapons. So that has political implications. And so that's another part. In the middle of all this, by the way, Israel has surfaced some submarines that have gone through the Suez Canal, much to everyone's embarrassment. And that got Iran's attention. They've got three of these, getting two more. Of the three they own, interestingly enough, two of them were gifts to them by Germany, the German parliament, in reparation for the Holocaust. The third one they paid for. And they've got two more coming that I think they're paying for. But in any case, these are interesting boats. The torpedo tubes have been enlarged so they can fire cruise missiles out of them. And so, and here's our interesting leader that is unabashedly, we'll talk more about him as we go here. You can't talk about any of these things without talking about Islam. So I have a good chance to. We don't try to play favorites. We have something to offend everyone. We'll probably have some comments here. The rise of Islam is your biggest challenge to the West. We all need to understand the origin, the nature, and the agenda of Islam. We do not suggest that the rank and file Muslims are guilty of the extremism characterizing their leadership. But we do need to understand what we're up against, and not be blinded by politically correct propaganda. But you show me a moderate Muslim, and I'll show you someone who's not following the directions of his leaders. And that's just a reality. We're dealing here with a theological conflict, not geopolitical or economic goals in the traditional sense. The most honest statement I've seen in the media on the subject came from Osama bin Laden. And he said, this is a war between Islam and Christianity. And that's a forthright, candid declaration. The jihad will never end. It will last to the day of judgment. Now, Islam is not just a religion, nor is it a cult. In its fullest form, it's a complete, total, 100% system of life. It has religious, legal, political, economic, social, and military components. You need to understand that. And let's take a look at how it operates. This is going to be a profile that may surprise you. Islamization. It begins when there are sufficient Muslims in a country to agitate for their religious privileges. And who would deny those, right? When politically correct, tolerant, and culturally diverse societies agree to Muslim demands for their religious privileges, some of the other components tend to creep in as well. Now, as long as the Muslim population remains around or under 2% in any given country, they will be, for the most part, regarded as peace-loving minority and not as a threat to other citizens. That's the case in the United States, which is 0.6%, Australia 1.5%, Canada 1.9%, China 1.8%, Italy 1.5%, Norway 1.8%. These are all less than 2%. And things are, you know, quite manageable. When you get more than 2%, say from 2 to 5%, they begin to proselytize from other ethnic minorities and disaffected groups, often with major recruiting in the jails and among street gangs. That's what's going on in Denmark, Germany, United Kingdom, Spain, and Thailand. Each one of these is more than 2%, less than 5%. See, it fits the profile. From 5%, they begin to exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to their percentage of the population. For example, they will push for the introduction of halal. That's their unique dietary requirements. And that also secures employment for some of the food preparation jobs for the Muslims. That's what's occurring in France, Philippines, Sweden, Switzerland, Netherlands, and Trinidad. When the Muslims approach 10% of the population, they tend to increase the lawlessness as a means of complaint about their conditions. In Paris, we see these car burnings. In Amsterdam, we see these wild displays over some cartoons that were published. These tensions start to be seen daily, particularly in the Muslim sections in Guyana, India, Israel, Kenya, and Russia. There you're talking between 10 and 15% population. After they reaching 20%, the nations can expect hair-trigger rioting, jihad military formations, sporadic killings, burnings of Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, as in Ethiopia and some of the other locations. At 40%, nations experience widespread massacres, chronic terror attacks, and ongoing militia warfare, such as in Bosnia, Chad, and Lebanon, which is from 40 to 60%. So you need to realize the Quran is a warrior code. There's not one commandment in it to love anything. There's over 100 commands to violence against the non-Muslims, and even violence against the moderate Muslims. Now, you get over 60%, nations experience unfettered persecution of non-believers of all other religions, including the non-conforming Muslims. Sporadic ethnic cleansing, genocide, the use of Sharia law as a weapon, and jizya, the tax placed on infidels. And that's what's going on in Albania, Malaysia, Qatar, and Sudan, which again is 60 to 80%. Over 80%, we can expect daily intimidation, violent jihad, some state-run ethnic cleansing, even some genocide, as these nations drive out the infidels and move towards 100% Islam. And this is what's going on in Bangladesh, Egypt, Gaza, Indonesia, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Morocco, Pakistan, Syria, Tajikistan, Turkey, and the United Arab Republics. Do the math. It's important to understand that in some countries, even with less than 100%, they live in ghettos, like in France. The minority populations live in ghettos. They don't assimilate to the population. They live in their own conclaves, which are 100%, within that conclave, they're 100% Muslim. and they live by Sharia law. The national police don't enter those ghettos. There are no national courts, nor schools, nor non-Muslim religious facilities. In such situations, Muslims do not integrate with the community at large. The children attend madrasas, and they learn only the Quran. That's all they're taught. To even associate with an infidel is considered a crime in those communities. In certain nations, Muslim imams and extremists exercise more power than the national average would indicate. And by the way, these deaths, the so-called honor deaths in the United States, are becoming a problem. They're usually executed by a member of the family. And they're usually hidden from media. Don't generally like to deal with that. And you can check all this stuff out in a number of books, but probably the best one is Dr. Hammond's book, Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, The Historical Roots and the Contemporary Threat. But you think that's scary? Let's take another look at it. Let's talk about demographics. If I give you a list of the Muslims, there's 11 million Muslims in the Americas, 84, I can go through all these numbers, and all they are a bunch of dry statistics, right? You're adding up to about 1.5 billion people. That, I don't know if that means much to us. See, that's a static snapshot. Let's take another look at this. Let's understand that for a culture to maintain itself for more than 25 years, there must be a fertility rate of 2.11 children per family. Basic statistical model here. No culture has ever reversed a 1.9 fertility rate. A 1.3 is impossible to reverse. It would take 80 to 100 years to correct itself. Okay. Well, if you have, understand this, if you have two people and they have a child, you now have half as many children as parents. Here's two sets of parents, each with a child. When those two children marry and have a child, nominally here, you have now 1/4 as many grandchildren as parents. Do you see the natural attrition that takes place in a singular model? As the population shrinks, so does the culture. Okay? Well, in France, they have a fertility rate of 1.8. In England, 1.6. Greece, 1.3. Germany, 1.3. Italy, 1.2. Spain, 1.1. The EU, as a 31-country package, 1.38. Each one substantially below 2.11, which is your break-even. In a matter of a few years, Europe, as we know it, will cease to exist. That's the reality. Take a look at European immigration. Since 1990, 90% of the immigration has been Islamic. France has a fertility rate of 1.8, but the Islamic fertility rate has an average of 8.1. There are 10 and 15 children families, very typical, but the statistical average is 8 to 1. 30% in France, 30% of the children 20 year and younger are Muslim. By 2027, 1 in 5 Frenchmen will be Muslim. In 39 years, France will be an Islamic republic. England. In the last 30 years, they had 82,000 Muslims that grew to 2.5 million, a multiplication of 30 to 1. In the Netherlands, 50% of all newborn children are Muslim. In 15 years, half of the population of the Netherlands will be Muslim. Just the statistics. Russia, they have 23 million Muslims, 1 out of 5. 40% of the Russian army will shortly be Muslim. Belgium, 25% of the population is Muslim. 50% of all newborns are Muslim. 1/3 of all European children will be born to Muslim families by 2025. That's only 17 years away. Where 1/3 of all European children will be born to Muslim families. 1/3. The German government officially has declared the following. The fall of the German population can no longer be stopped. Its downward spiral is no longer reversible. It will be a Muslim state by the year 2050. That's an official proclamation from the Germany Federal Statistics Office. I don't normally quote Muammar al-Qaddafi in my slides, but I thought you might be interested in this particular quote of his. He says, there are signs that Allah will grant victory to Islam in Europe without swords, without guns, without conquest. We don't need terrorists. We don't need homicide bombers. The 50-plus million Muslims in Europe will turn it into a Muslim continent within a few decades. That's a reality. That's a tidal wave coming here. Canada, 1.6 fertility rate. But they need 2.11, right? Well, between 2001 and 2006, they had a population increase of 1.6 million. But of that, the immigration was 1.2 million. United States, fertility rate is 1.6. With the influx of Latino nations, it's 2.11. 1970, we had 100,000 Muslims. In 2008, we had 9 million Muslims. And furthermore, we have reports that are documented in our briefing packages. Muslim conclaves in the United States and Canada have been tasked to compile target lists of all the Jews and Christians in their neighborhoods. That's interesting. Something else you obviously understand that the House of Islam is divided into two parts, the Sunnis and the Shiites. About 80% of Islam are Sunnis and 20% are Shiites. The Shiites are primarily Iran and Yemen. Now, they have a debate that's gone on since the 7th century as to who should succeed. I won't go through all that here. We've got better things to do. But the main point is the Shiite eschatology especially emphasized the role of the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, that is going to usher in the end times. And the 12th Imam didn't die back in 873. In their view, he disappeared, destined to reappear at the end of time by a big tumult that is supposed to come. Now, the reason this is, we don't hold to that eschatology, but there is a guy that does, a guy by the name of Ahmadinejad. You know, he's not one of these crazy narcissistic dictators. He is a devout Muslim, takes all this very seriously. And he personally believes that he has been called by Allah to usher in the tumult that will bring in the 12th Imam. And in his mind, he doesn't mind if it destroys Iran, because he regards that as an acceptable sacrifice for the good of Islam. We need to understand his mindset. He's not demented. He's just a devoted follower of what Islam teaches. And he's committed. And that's what makes his access to nuclear weapons so terrifying. And there's someone else that may help make his dream a reality. So that's what we're facing here. Now, do we have time for this? Let's see. We probably don't have time to get into the... let's just go to the next one here. I want to hold to my time. Obviously, on all these topics, we can talk a lot more about the Magog invasion, all that, but I think most of you are probably familiar with that anyhow. I want to put something on the screen, which I believe is true, but if you accept it, you flunk the course. I'm going to put something on the screen that is patently absurd. And if you accept this preposterous proposition, you flunk the course. Here's what I'm going to put on the screen. I believe we are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee or climbed the mountains of Judea. I believe that the period of time we're entering has more visibility in the Bible than even the gospel period, by a factor of 7 to 1, by the way, but in any case. The real question is, how do you challenge this ridiculous statement? You've got to do two things. You've got to find out what the Bible really says, not what Chuck Missler says or any TV or radio guy. Find out for yourself. It's too important to delegate to anyone else. And it's interesting that today we live in the most unique environment in history, because you can get to the original language of the Bible without knowing Hebrew or Greek. You could put your little cursor over a word and a pop-up menu will tell you what that Greek or Hebrew underlying word means. It'll even diagram the sentences for you if you want. And those facilities are free. The software to do that on your computer is free. If you don't have a computer, well, you probably need some kind of appliance to do what I'm talking about here. But if you don't have that software, get on the internet and look at the Blue Letter Bible. Those resources are available and they're free of charge. And I'm going to acquaint you with some other resources before we finish this here. But the second thing you've got to do is find out what's really going on. And you won't find out on the 10 o'clock news, because you've got a media that has its own agenda. And that's an agenda of its own. Pilate so cynically asked, what's truth? That's a question you need to... Hello? Are we... I think they're editing my thing back there. There is an intelligent source I want you to be acquainted with, and that's the ISCAR database. So bear with me. But the real thing, setting that aside for the moment, before you leave this hill, I want you to ask yourself, what is God calling you to do? How many of you are saved by the blood of Jesus Christ? Can I see your hands? Praise God. What are you doing with it? What's the fruit that you're bearing? Every one of us has been called in broad terms, but we've also all been called individually. And your individual calling isn't the same as the guy next to you. There are specific, and the great adventure in life is to discover what he has called you to do. I had, by the grace of God, a life of adventure, and I won't bore you with that whole chronology. It's irrelevant. Because the most, in a life of wild experiences, the most exciting one is right now doing exactly what we're doing here on this hill. I'm going to suggest that every one of us in this room needs to raise the bar on our spiritual walk. In this audience, I don't have to define that term. That's a rhetoric you relate to, I assume, right? How do you raise the bar in your spiritual walk? Probably several things. Getting rid of inappropriate baggage, whatever. You can figure that out. But what it will include in any case is a commitment to a systematic study of the Word of God. Well, you say, I read my Bible every day. That's devotional reading. I'm taking that for granted. I'm talking about a systematic study of the Word of God. And how many of you are in a study group during the week? You know, that speaks volumes of the kind of audience I've got here. I just completed a 13-city swing through to Australia and New Zealand. And 1,000 people venues in the 13 different cities. Many people drove 6 to 8 hours to get there. Probably very analogous to the situation here in many ways. And I'd ask that question, and virtually 90% of the people. Hello? Okay. This grassroots hunger for the Word of God is worldwide, very exciting. But whatever God's calling you to do, my urgency is to do it now. Time is getting short. I sometimes say life is like a roll of toilet paper. It goes faster near the end, right? Okay. But I want you to be aware of the fact there's a worldwide fellowship in cyberspace that you can be part of in the Koine Institute. It's worldwide. It's non-denominational, but very fundamental. It's a supplement, not a replacement, for a local church. Don't misunderstand us here. But the interesting thing about it, to take a course will take a couple hours a week. Any time that you choose. You do it on the fly. You do it when you have, yes, it will take a couple hours. Maybe two or three for most. But it can be early in the morning, late at night. It can be Tuesdays or Thursdays, whenever you want. Because it's all, you know, text messaging back and forth. But you're going to be in a classroom, virtual classroom, with 11 other people. And those 11 other people will be from anywhere 40 countries in the world. And you'll get to really know them because of the discussions that go on. It's astonishing how the bonding takes place. It's fabulous. At the end of the week, there'll be a 10-question multiple choice quiz matching. So, you know, it's automated. It's a machine-readable type of... At the end of, say, your 12-week course or whatever, there'll be 100 questions, or 100 maybe plus. But the idea is, again, it's a multiple choice. And then you get a transcript on file that can be sent to any university. And we've had 4 PhDs graduate in which half of all the course requirements were done through the Institute. And there are more and more institutes accepting our transcripts. But you can do it on your own clock's the point. It's a volunteer think tank because you'll be interacting and generating work product in the database. And the fellowship is committed to help you achieve whatever it is you believe God is calling you to do. It isn't necessarily to be a pastor. It could be any of a lot of other things. But as you can define that, the fellowship will define practicums around that to give you the training and the growth to achieve what that calling that you feel you're being called to. As I mentioned before, there's two arms of here, and we have the three that I described earlier, and the IDB is there. And I think what I'll... Well, let's see. Let me just talk about this a little bit more. The database is fed by our own surveillance network, subscription services, and there's the list of them, James, DEFCA, Brookings, Cato, Heritage, Oxford Analytica, and so forth. And, of course, all our internal resources are in the database. And it's divided not into 10 strategic trends, as you guys may be used to. It's split into some 30 or 40 surveillance sectors, and the geopolitical ones, technological ones, cultural, economic, and so forth. And it isn't text. It's 17 different media types. We don't use term papers. We use bullet briefings as work products among the students. It's easier to throw together a multimedia presentation today with modern software than it is to try to grind through an academic term paper. And so what happens then is everything in the database has a stub that describes its source and qualifies it, and it's able to respond, build a file folder, if you will, we call it a folio, of whatever question you're after, and from that you frame your own response. That gets graded by your class, and those grades are normalized and added to the filing. When it gets put in the database, it's added to the stub, and so the previous work product, in a qualified sense, is available to further work. So it's the interaction of the members with a database that justifies the label of this as a think tank, not just a school. And so we think this is, we have, by the way, you can get a free one page, whether you're a member or not. You can sign up on our website, you can sign up, either website will do it. You sign up for what we call e-news, a little one page thing that comes to you once a week, tells you what happened this week that's biblically relevant, and it gives you the links that are following that competently. And it's a little one-pager, and if you get tired of it, you can terminate it, but it's free, and it comes to you to stimulate your awareness of what's going on. And it's generated, of course, from our own intelligence database here. This is the source for the briefing packages. In the past, they've been my own attempt to bluff my way through some topic. Not anymore. We have a staff that really, really researches this stuff and qualifies it, and the quality, professional quality, is obviously on an uptick. And we regard this as a resource for pastors. If you're a pastor, you can arrange to have access to this database. That's what it's all about. And we also have, I spent 30 years in the corporate boardrooms. And my dream is to be able to put a report on a boardroom table that'll have the same credibility to a board of directors as Brookings or Cato or one of the traditional think tanks would have, except ours will be from a biblical point of view, biblical inerrancy point of view. And, of course, because of the access to this is valuable enough to corporations, we have ways that they, in exchange for access, they help support the subscriptions, which are expensive. And so that's what we are. We have a little program. We want our members to balance their progress in all three tracks, not just become Bible verse experts or any one thing, but when they get to the first level of all three, they get a bronze medallion and status and privileges that go with that. And when they get to the second level of all three in a balanced way, they get a silver medallion and finally a gold. Gold medallion holders, by the way, include people like Joseph Farah, who is a founder and head of World at Daily, Jerry Corsi, which you follow some of the things going on. He's a gold medallion holder. Charles Ryrie, Tim LaHaye, I could go on and on. But that's what we're all about. And so we have two websites. Chaos.org is the publisher. StudyCenter.com is the campus site. But I want you to get involved. You can undertake a lifelong program. You can volunteer to be a teaching assistant. Every course has a live person coaching the group to completion. And it's the strength and enthusiasm of the teaching assistants that's so contagious. We have area representatives all around the world. We have research assistants that are eyes and ears because of their professional qualifications or their proximity to centers of influence. We also have specialists in various areas. We try to get a specialist in each surveillance sector to maintain a competent, current perspective of what the relevant sources are in that area. And we also have special programs for incentives and student prizes and practicums and internships. And we're adding courses that from other sources, obviously, Walter Martin and what have you. So that's who we are. And I ran over. That happened once before, I think. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.